And we will go on to the last case of the day, which is Blake versus United States. And it is number 113183. And, okay. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Mr. Carter.
May it please the court, Madam Chief Judge. If I could, I'd like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal.
Of course.
I'd like to focus on two of our arguments here today. First, that Mr. Blake's 2255 petition should not have been dismissed because of the ineffective assistance of his initial conflicted counsel, Frank Fabry. And second, because his substitute counsel was also ineffective when he failed to move to dismiss the indictment against Mr. Blake for a violation of the Speedy Trial Act. Now, when Mr. Blake first learned of the government's investigation into his activities, when his property was searched and seized in July 2006, he went and he consulted an attorney, a seasoned criminal defense attorney who'd been practicing for over 30 years. But unfortunately for Mr. Blake, that attorney, Frank Fabry, did not tell him that he had a conflict, even at that moment. He had a conflict because, like Mr. Blake, Mr. Fabry was under investigation.
Let's agree, for sake of argument, that the conflict is established, that everybody agrees that Mr. Fabry was in a conflicted position when he represented Mr. Blake. The next question is what prejudice came from that. And according to my calculations, there were 2 months that Mr. Fabry represented Mr. Blake, during which there was a proffer of evidence, which the court eventually suppressed, so none of that evidence was used in the prosecution of Mr. Blake. True?
That's right.
Okay. And that basically there was a motion to continue filed by Mr. Fabry in the presence of his client, which his client disavowed.
Yes.
So it was advanced but not granted, so it didn't derail the proceedings in terms of delaying the trial, right?
Well, Judge, the motion to continue filed by Mr. Fabry was not granted. It was withdrawn, as you...
Well, withdrawn is what I meant. But it didn't generate a ruling that delayed the trial.
No, Your Honor, but what happened next did delay the trial, and that was the government filed a motion to allow the original prosecuting attorney to withdraw, and also a motion to have the court conduct an inquiry into Mr. Fabry's potential conflict.
I'm trying to figure out where the prejudice was from Mr. Fabry's representation.
Well,
assuming it was conflicted, and I don't have too much trouble making that decision, but where was the harm to Mr. Blake from Mr. Fabry's representation?
Well, Your Honor, the proffer wasn't used against Mr. Blake. However, I liken it to unringing the bell. Once he's provided the proffer, it provides the government a significant source of leads to use against him. And the continuance...
Well, that's not correct, I don't think, counsel. I think the government's obligated when they get a proffer that's unusable because of a ruling by the judicial officer. They can't use it. They have to show they have other sources for that evidence, an independent source. So I don't think that it's like unringing the bell. I think it just requires the prosecution to present evidence that's not tainted by that proffer.
Well, Judge, even setting aside the proffer, the delay that occurred after Mr. Fabry's conflict was finally known to Mr. Blake did cause Mr. Blake prejudice in that additional charges were brought against Mr. Blake. And Mr. Blake has argued in his original 2255 petition.
But that happened on the next guy's watch, didn't it? What was the ensuing counsel's name? Stinger.
Mr. Stinger?
Stinger.
Yes.
Stinger. By the time that happened, that there was additional time for additional charges to be brought, that wasn't Mr. Fabry's doing or his fault, was it?
Well, Judge, if Mr. Fabry had not been forced out of the case because of the conflict, the case could have gone forward on January 9th, and we believe that the additional charges would not have been brought by that point. And, in fact, when the government made...
Well, that's pretty speculative, wouldn't you say? Because the government often brings these things when they see it's going to trial, and they bring them sort of at the last minute when they're getting everything put on the table because they see that there's no basis for a plea. So they often file these things immediately prior to trial. It's not that there was a delay that was caused that generated that.
Well, Judge, all I can point to is that the additional charges weren't brought until after the conflict came to light and the case did not go forward on January 9th. And even when the government brought to the district court's attention Mr. Fabry's conflict, the government's motion indicated that it didn't believe that the trial was actually going to take place as Mr. Blake wanted and as soon as January 9th. And they made that representation in their motion to have the district court conduct an inquiry into Mr. Fabry's conflict. And Mr. Blake also argues that if the case had gone forward on January 9th, the testimony of his co-defendant would have been brought forward. Now, I think the fundamental
problem... Would have been available?
Would not have been available.
Would not have been.
Now, I think one of the fundamental problems in this case is the fact that as of October 2006, when Fabry first entered his formal appearance, Mr. Fabry knew about the conflict that he labored under but did not tell Mr. Blake. But not only that, the district court knew or reasonably should have known of Mr. Fabry's conflict, and the assistant U.S. attorney prosecuting the case knew or should have known. And the court knew or should have known because in February of 2006, in an earlier case, the district judge had conducted an inquiry into Fabry's conflict and given that defendant in the earlier case the chance that Blake never had, which was to waive the conflict and go forward with Fabry or to get a new attorney. And, you know, it was the intervening 2 months that caused the problem. This court has held that...
Well, I have difficulty with your argument that the district court should have known of the conflict, but what I gleaned from the record, maybe you need to correct my impression, is that there was a prior case involving Mr. Fabry, and an issue of a potential conflict had arisen, but it didn't come back to the district court judge, that somehow it got resolved and life went on. And when the second case involving Mr. Blake presented something comparable, the judge says, oh, yes, I remember before there was an issue. And then he said, but I thought it all got worked out, so I didn't think there was any problem with Blake either because he wasn't drawn into problem solving or making adjudications on the first one. Is that not a correct statement of the record?
Well, I think that the record shows that the trial judge conducted the inquiry in the earlier case when he found out about the potential conflict. And here the inquiry didn't happen until December 2006. When it could have happened, and
did he make a ruling on the first one?
Fabry was allowed to continue the representation.
Yeah, I'm sorry. Go ahead. You were answering correctly.
Yes, Fabry was allowed to continue that representation, and the defendant in that case had waived the conflict.
Was that by an adjudication by the trial judge?
Your Honor, I'm not sure.
That's what I thought the record showed, that he didn't have to rule on the conflict. That somehow it either got resolved and everybody waived it or something.
Well, the defendant in that case did waive the conflict. That is clear.
You know, we need to consider carefully the three factors that courts use to determine if a Speedy Trial Act dismissal should be with or without prejudice. And as I see it, this was a serious crime, so the first factor favors a without prejudice with dismissal. But the government behaved badly, so the second factor favors a dismissal with prejudice. The third factor is very, very difficult for me. Give me your best argument that the administration of justice will be best served by allowing an obviously guilty person to go free. And I ask this because we obviously cannot find an effective assistance if the attorney simply failed to bring a losing claim.
Well, Judge, in this case, I think the conflict of interest that Mr. Fabry labored under was so severe, and the fact that the government didn't bring it to the court's attention until it was almost necessary to continue the trial, and those factors call... I think bring the administration of justice factor into Mr. Blake's favor. This conflict was a severe conflict. Mr. Fabry had two masters. He was, on the one hand, trying to maintain his own status being out of prison and also trying to probably protect his career, and he didn't disclose his conflict, and the government didn't disclose
it. There's some dispute, though, about when the government lawyer, the AUSA assigned to the case, actually knew about the conflict, because the case was being prosecuted in another district, and AUSA apparently had been alerted that he might have to be a witness in the case, but he was fenced off from anything about that case until somebody in the know said that Mr. Fabry is going to be prosecuted. Then that sort of raised his concerns, didn't it?
Well, Judge, in his motion to bring the conflict to the district court's attention, he made clear that it could have been brought earlier. So the government admitted that the motion to bring forward the conflict could have been made earlier. And with respect to the issue of the different U.S. Attorney's Office prosecuting Blake, and that was from the Central District of Illinois, whereas Blake's case was going forward in the Southern District, the fact is that the two offices had to be working together because the assistant U.S. attorney who ended up withdrawing from Blake's case was a potential witness against Mr.
Well, that doesn't mean they're working together.
Well, it means that Fabry has a very important and incentive, a very key incentive to cooperate with the government's attorney. And Mr. Fabry said as much to the district court. He said that he felt that he may have made a conscious effort to support the assistant U.S. attorney prosecuting the case, and he found it disingenuous that the government hadn't brought the conflict to the court's attention any earlier.
Judge Rovner, may I ask one more question?
You may sit here all day, and they have to stay.
But you don't. I want you to stay, too. There was some back and forth in the briefing about the fact that you didn't specifically disavow the information in the government's speedy trial calculation chart, that you didn't take issue with that. Do you take issue with that computation chart, or are you just saying that there was sort of silent softness in that schedule? What's wrong about that chart that they gave us?
Well, Your Honor, in our reply brief, we went through each of the government's calculations. But as a more fundamental issue, we think that much of the motion practice after Fabry's conflict came to light was characterized by a dilatory motive and bad faith.
So have you made your own calculation? How late was it?
We think all of the motions after the conflict motion should not have been excluded.
So how much delay was it?
Over 140 days. So over 70 days more past the 70-day speedy trial act.
And have you done a chart to that effect?
We did not do a chart, Your Honor, but we're not aware of any cases that require a specific chart, and we did address each of the specific motions.
Well, no, there's no requirement of a chart, but it is a helpful rejoinder. Do it in your next case.
Thank you. Okay. Nothing further, Judge.
Thank you so much. Hi, Mr. Garrison.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court, my name is Bob Garrison. I'm an assistant U.S. attorney from the Southern District of Illinois, and I was one of the three assistant U.S. attorneys who tried the Blake case back in 2007, although I was not the lead attorney. I thought I would begin by
Could I start you off, if
yes,
you
ma'am.
Don't mind? Because I think we need to start with the admissions and legal positions that the office took in the court below. In the motion for a determination as to an actual or potential conflict, it was essentially admitted that this was an actual conflict, that you knew about it all along, that you simply thought the issue would go away when Fabry was indicted. And what I've been wondering is why you shouldn't be held to those factual admissions and legal positions now.
Your Honor, I'm not sure I can agree with the premise of your question. I would also point out that the second that the United States Attorney, Mr. Killian, Assistant United States Attorney, found out that there, and I would describe it as a potential conflict. Uh-huh. I would submit that there was never, to this day, an actual conflict in which, for an actual conflict to exist, the U.S. Attorney's Office would have had to collude with Fabree for some purpose to create an actual conflict.
But am I incorrect thinking that in your conflict motion, in the government's conflict motion, that the issue was the same, whether the prosecutor's office was acting as a prosecutor of the defendant's attorney or as a witness against him, and now the office won't concede that point?
I looked for a case in the brief and reply brief of Mr. Blake in which he could cite us to a single instance in which a prosecutor in District 1 was investigating an attorney, and as a result it created a conflict for that attorney in District 2. I would submit to the court that there are simply no such cases. Returning to the point that I made, we were absolutely forbidden long before Fabree entered in the Blake case to have anything to do with that investigation. The only thing we knew was that the Central District of Illinois had launched a mere investigation, which had continued for, going from memory, about a year and 8 months by the time of the Blake trial, with nothing further informing us that it was going anywhere. So what we had was a potential conflict of interest.
So, in other words, you did not know before the conflict of interest motion that the proceedings were a sham and that Blake was going to have to start over with the new attorney as soon as the conflict came to light or as soon as he was indicted?
Judge Rovner, I'm not entirely sure I understand your question. May I just explain what I believe are the facts?
Sure.
The key date here is when the government filed its motion for a conflict hearing on December 20th, 2006.
Uh-huh.
Prior to that time, this was the complete extent of the knowledge of AUSA Killian, who at that time was prosecuting the case. AUSA Killian knew that there had been a long-term investigation in another district of Mr. Fabree, and he knew that 9 months prior to Fabree's trial, that Judge Murphy had... the same issue had come up in another trial, another criminal case in front of Judge Murphy, and that the client, the defendant in the earlier case in front of Judge Murphy, had been allowed to waive whatever conflict occurred.
Could I just stop you for 1 second? Mr. Killian knew that there was a long-term investigation in another district. Are you saying that he didn't know that it related to your district?
I would suggest that he did not know that all he knew, ma'am, Judge Rovner, was, A, there is this investigation in another district into something Fabree did. You, Mr. Killian, are instructed to get out of it and to wall yourself off from that investigation henceforth.
Because you may be a witness.
Yes, which would imply that...
It would imply that... It was going on in your district, not some other district.
Well, it would imply that the investigation might involve something Fabree did in our district. But, I mean, it is merely an implication. Certainly, Killian, AUSA Killian, had no actual knowledge of what Fabree had done. And as I'm sure the court is probably aware, the way these things customarily work is when another district begins an investigation, the original district, in this case the Southern District of Illinois, is moved out of the case. It is walled off. That is just standard operating procedure. It's how it's always been done. I wanted Judge Rovner to make a point briefly I didn't make before about the factual status of this on the key dates in December 2006. At the time of the final pretrial conference on December 18, shortly after that, AUSA Killian found out for the very first time, and this is in the brief, so it's in the record, for the very first time that an indictment of Fabree was imminent. Killian learned that from a DEA agent named Mike Raig, and this is in the record, R-A-H-G, and within 24 hours of learning from Special Agent Raig, that Fabri was in serious trouble, unbeknownst to Killian, and was about to be indicted, he came back before the district court and disclosed everything. And the last point I wanted to make is that AUSA Killian did that, forget excludable days and countable days, from the date that Blake was indicted until AUSA Killian stood before the district court, only 58 calendar days had expired. So that, therefore, the district court was given ample opportunity, well within the speedy trial calculation, to address this issue of the potential conflict. And it did so. It took every remedial action that the courts have suggested, the U.S. Supreme Court in Holloway and the Seventh Circuit in Fish. The district court did that, and it did it within the speedy trial time of 70 days. So I return to what Judge Barker said when she was questioning my esteemed opponent. What possible prejudice could Blake have suffered here? He was... Yes, ma'am.
No, go ahead. I mean, see, Fabri said that he had many sleepless days over the conflict, and I mean...
Unbeknownst to us.
You didn't know that.
Oh, indeed not.
Okay.
I have spent a long time since I
had
a heart-to-heart with Mr. Fabri. But the point I wanted to make is Mr. Blake was asked after 58 days by the court, do you want Fabri or not? If he had wanted Fabri, he could have had him. He said, I don't want him. Every continuance that was granted after Fabri was permitted to withdraw was for the benefit of Mr. Blake, not the government. It was to ensure Blake's right, and the court showed the same solicitude for Blake's rights that are highly recommended in the precedents of Holloway and Fish, which are cited in Mr. Blake's briefs. Finally, because I believe I'm probably running very close to my time.
This is an important case.
Well, I couldn't agree more. It seems to me the essence, the very nut of Mr. Blake's position in both his original brief and his reply brief is that there was collusion and conspiracy between this disgraced attorney, Frank Fabri, and the United States Attorney's Office in the Southern District. And for the purpose of what? For what purpose do they allege that we would have entered into this conspiracy? You heard a case earlier this morning involving that corrupt police officer where there was a real conspiracy. Now, what is the alleged purpose, that being to cover up torture? What is the alleged purpose of the conspiracy here? So that the government could get a continuance? I mean, that's just laughable. We could have, on the time we disclosed the conflict, the potential conflict of interest, only 24 non-excludable days had expired. Do you really think that, and I say this respectfully, that if the government wanted a continuance 24 days into the speedy trial clock with 46 days yet to run, we couldn't have just said, Judge Murphy, we need a continuance for whatever purpose. There are 46 days left in the trial clock. Please give us a continuance. Then instead of doing that, something that the U.S. Attorney does perhaps more than a dozen times every month, that instead of that, we would manipulate this corrupt attorney, Mr. Fabri, into getting a continuance for us that we could have otherwise not obtained. I mean, quite frankly, I believe that's a ridiculous position. It is conspiracy theories gone wild, is what that position is.
What about the allegation that Mr. Blake's counsel has made that, but for the delay, you wouldn't have filed the additional charges, the co-defendant would have perhaps not been available to the government for its case, so forth?
Well, my response to that, Judge Barker, is there is no evidence of that. That comes from the febrile imagination of Mr. Byron Blake, the defendant. In point of fact, and it's in the record, look at the original trial date of January 9, 2007. That's the date when Mr. Blake wanted to go to trial. The government had already written in witnesses and it's in the record, we were already writing in witnesses for the January 9, 2007 trial. The government was ready to go to trial. The co-defendant, Ivory, had proffered and implicated Blake before Mr. Fabry ever entered the case. You know from the record and from the original appeal that the case was based on hours and hours of Title III overhears in which Mr. Blake was arranging dope deals, corroborated by the testimony of Mr. Ivory, the co-defendant. There is nothing whatsoever in the record to indicate that the government wasn't ready to go to trial as scheduled on January 9, 2007.
I need to clarify some things with you. There is the government's motion for determination as to an actual or potential conflict of interest. In that motion, the office has admitted that there is an actual conflict of interest between Fabry and his client. Is that true?
I believe we thought that there was a potential conflict. If you could cite, I have the document in front of me. If you could cite me to the paragraph number, Judge Rubin.
I can't do that.
It has always been our position, Judge Rubin, that Fabry had a potential conflict.
Because the way I read it was that your office was admitting that under the case law, an attorney's prosecution on unrelated criminal charges by the same office prosecuting the defendant creates an actual conflict, not just a potential conflict of interest, which is what I hear you arguing today. And I thought that in that motion, your office admitted that even though the Southern District is recused in Fabry's prosecution, several Southern District bosses were potential witnesses against Fabry. So the issue was the same. Indeed, as I recall, the prosecuting attorney in Blake's case was one of the potential witnesses. Take a look at paragraph 6 on page 3 of the motion, because this is what you say there. The government admits, quote, the United States could have presented this motion at an earlier point in time. However, until recently believed that the case was in a posture where there was more time prior to trial of this matter, and that the investigation of Attorney Fabry would have proceeded to a prosecution by that point in time, which likely would have self-resolved the issue. So that's an admission that your office knew that the proceedings in Blake's case were a farce, because they knew his attorney was about to be indicted, and that you were counting on delays in Blake's case to self-resolve the issue, because Fabry would be indicted and Blake would have to start over again with a new attorney. What wasn't counted on, it would seem, was this defendant who's chomping at the bit to get to trial and to exercise his Speedy Trial Act rights. I mean, in the usual case, we wouldn't believe a defendant's after-the-fact claim that he wanted to go to trial as soon as possible. But Blake's claim can't be doubted, because it was not after the fact, before he knew anything about the conflict. He literally jumps up in court, and he opposes his own lawyer's motion to continue the trial. He tried to get to trial as fast as possible. So I just have a problem.
Well, if I might respond to your concern, and Your Honor, the one thing that you have just stated that to which I take some strong exceptions is that the government, in the form of AUSA Killian, knew Fabry was about to be indicted. The government found out Fabry was about to be indicted less than 24 hours, ma'am, before it filed the document you reference. Prior to learning from DEA Special Agent Mike Raig, after December 18th, bearing in mind the document you quoted was filed on December 20th, The only things AUSA Killian knew were that there had been a long-term investigation of Fabry, that he was walled off from it, and that in a previous case in front of Judge Murphy 9 months earlier, the defendant in the previous case had been allowed to waive whatever the problem was. Now, it is our position, Your Honor, that that was the sum total of AUSA Killian's knowledge, and that when he did, in fact, learn after December 18th that Fabry was about to be indicted, he immediately came before the court with this motion for a determination of conflict of interest, literally within 24 hours. So the government approached the situation with clean hands, and Judge Murphy did everything he could from that point on within the Speedy Trial Act to ensure that Blake had unconflicted counsel at every subsequent proceeding, starting with the conflict hearing itself.
In the motion that was filed by Mr. Killian, that it's captioned a motion for potential conflict or something like that?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. And so does the government in that document say there is an actual conflict?
I don't read it that way, ma'am. And although, I mean,
the purpose of the motion to get the issue aired?
Absolutely.
So that the judge could determine if there was a conflict?
To get it aired immediately, and only 58 days after Blake had been arraigned.
Should I read that sentence again? From paragraph 6 on page 3 of the motion, quote, the United States could have presented this motion at an earlier point in time. However, until recently, believed that the case was in a posture where there was more time prior to trial of this matter, and that the investigation of Attorney Fabry would have proceeded to a prosecution by that point in time, which would likely have self-resolved the issue.
And Judge Romner, the question about that paragraph that you're addressing to me is what, ma'am?
Well, it certainly looks like it's an admission that the office knew that the proceedings in Blake's case was a real problem because they knew his attorney was about to indict it. And when you read that, it looks like, I'm not saying it is, I'm just saying, you know, what an ordinary reader might glean, it looks like that the office is counting on delays in Blake's case to, quote, self-resolve the issue, because Fabry's going to be indicted, and Blake then would have to start over again with a new attorney.
Your Honor, to me,
I'll go back.
Well, Your Honor, to me, the key point, and I think it's a misstatement, is that the government ever knew prior to December 19th that Fabry was about to indict it, and on December 20th, when it did know, it filed the motion from which you're quoting. I cannot sign off that prior to, after the pretrial conference on December 18th and prior to the filing of the motion on December 20th, that was the time frame in which the United States Attorney, AUSA Killian, learned that Fabry was about to be indicted. It was not before that, Judge Rovner. It was almost contemporaneous with the filing of this motion.
Do we know that for certain?
Well, there is absolutely no evidence to the contrary. It is not disputed that Killian had been walled off from the investigation. That isn't in dispute. There is no evidence to the contrary. And it is also not in dispute, although I would submit that Mr. Blake does somersaults in his reply brief to try to avoid it, is that he was being investigated by an entirely separate office. From early 2004 onwards, the only actual knowledge that AUSA Killian had was that there had been or was ongoing, not sure which, an investigation of Fabry. That is all that Killian knew prior to December, to the final pretrial conference on December 18th. That's, as I've said, that's the sum total of his knowledge. The indictment came less than 20, news that he was, that Fabry was about to be indicted came less than 24 hours after this motion, less than 24 hours before the motion in question was filed.
So it, isn't it true, Mr. Garrison, that there was this early activity before Judge Murphy about a potential conflict about which Killian didn't know much, except that there was a potential conflict.
And that it had been resolved.
And that it had been resolved. So let me finish my question.
I'm sorry.
Since that was the case, when the government says that this could have been filed earlier, I sort of heard that in a different way, I think, than what Judge Rovner hears it, but I'm not sure I'm right. And that is that...
I'm certainly not sure I'm right either.
Well, that was that... Fabry could have been indicted before the Blake indictment, and that would have resolved it because he wouldn't have been qualified to serve. And so in that sense, if things had happened sooner, we might have been able to present it.
Yes. The core problem
that,
here
and
is
that
not...
And the Fabry prosecution didn't move along very quickly, and then Blake gets indicted, and here we have this problem again.
And not only that, but... The U.S. attorney had no way of knowing that the investigation hadn't been resolved in Fabry's favor, given the fact that in the Amperin case, that was the early proceeding in front of Judge Murphy, it was brought up in front of Judge Murphy, and Judge Murphy said, okay, it's been resolved, it's been waived. We had no way of knowing that prior to December 19th that the case hadn't actually been resolved in Fabry's favor, let alone that Fabry was about to be indicted. That thunderbolt occurred shortly after the final pretrial hearing on December, the final pretrial hearing being December 18th.
In Blake's case.
Killian learned for the first time about the pending indictment, and on December 20th, he was back disclosing everything he knew to the court in the motion from which Judge Rovner just read.
Thank you.
Thank you, ma'am.
Oh, my goodness. How much extra time was that? How many? 13 minutes. Come on up. Help us out, Mr. Carter.
Judge, I'd just like to point to one instance in the government's request for determination as to an actual or a potential conflict of interest, and that's in paragraph 2. The government admitted the United States of America believes that Attorney Fabry has an actual or at least a significant potential conflict of interest. So I think that is at least another spot in their motion where they indicated that they at least believe the conflict was an actual conflict, or at the very least potential.
Or.
That's right.
I mean, the operative word there is or.
That's right.
They're basically saying, we don't know what we've got here. It doesn't pass the smell test.
Right.
Help us out, Judge Murphy.
Right. The other key admissions, I think, in this case come from Fabry himself when the conflict came to light. And it's at our appendix on page 77. And Mr. Fabry, this comes from Mr. Blake's 2255 petition. And Mr. Fabry stated that this situation is different than the Arnolfo Gonzalez-Torres. That's the earlier case from February 2006. Not because it's a year later, not because of any allegations involving this investigation, but the fact is that I approached the government about it originally. I find it disingenuous. I've had some sleepless days about this, but I have to direct myself to the respect of the court and to the interest of Mr. Blake. And on the next page of the appendix on A78, that colloquy continues with Mr. Fabry's description of why he thinks there was such a problem with the way that the conflict came to light. And I think the fundamental problem with it is that the conflict should have come to light. There should have been an inquiry earlier in October, as soon as Mr. Fabry entered his appearance.
Why didn't he raise it?
Mr. Fabry?
He knew about the investigation.
I'm not sure.
And if he was being diligent to his client, he wouldn't have accepted the retainer, right?
I think that he should have raised it, Your Honor, and I think that's part of the reason that Mr. Fabry's performance was ineffective.
So he's coming along a little bit after the fact saying, you should have saved me from myself.
That's true. That's true. But he's also pointing out that he pointed the situation out to the government, and they didn't make a motion for a determination of the conflict until after the continuance that Fabry sought was withdrawn by his client.
So Fabry was basically saying, I've been under investigation for a long time. It cropped up in this prior case. We resolved it. And it may crop up in this case, too. I'm just not sure. And then before it got resolved, he did get indicted. And then that put the issue front and center for the district court.
Right. But, Judge, I think that the inquiry still has to happen, even if it's just a potential conflict. And I fully agree that Fabry should have brought it to the court's attention and at least to his client's attention at the very earliest moment, but he didn't do that. But the court reasonably should have known about it, and so should the government have brought it to the court's attention sooner. If you have nothing further.
Is there anything you want to add?
No.
Any questions, anyone?
No, thank you.
All right. The case will be taken under advisement. You were appointed. Winston and Strawn and everyone at council table, and of course, you, Mr. Carter, have the sincere thanks of the court for taking on this difficult case and for doing the job that you've done. And we thank the government as well. Thank you. And our day is over, and the court will be in recess until tomorrow morning at 9:30, when there will be three other.
More fun.
Maybe nicer judges.
Thank you. Thank you, Your Honors.